You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
Joining the second Timers Club, we have Dr. Michael Swanson from the University of Otago, Otago Whakaihu Waka's political department, politics department. We're going to be talking to Michael all about Budget 2026. Who are the winners? Who are the losers? What's the vision? Are we all going crazy? Are we going to be all very sad? Good morning to you, Michael. Dr. Michael.
Morning, Zach.
It's good to have you on the show now, and now you have, a prefix?
I do.
To your name?
Yes. Yeah,
congratulations.
Since the last time we talked? Yeah, I've graduated.
So. How does it feel to have a prefix?
It's pretty nice having it read out.
Yeah.
It's always nice hearing it.
Yeah. Are you going to go for a Professor Michael Swanson?
Oh, who knows? Maybe one day.
How long will that take?
A long time.
Yeah?
A long time. And maybe some more money in the system to hire in that space.
We'll see how we go. Thank you for coming on the program again. I'm very, very appreciative to be talking to the budget about someone like you, very knowledgeable. I want to talk about the phrases from this year's budget announcement. I've picked up on cash bazooka, lolly scramble, temporary targeted support. They've been saying those for a while, though, so you know they've just fumbled into the budget lexicon. What have you noticed that the finance people are talking about?
Yeah, that I tell you, the media love the term lolly scramble, and the Prime Minister's used it a lot to talk about how it won't be a lolly scramble. They've actually spent more than they probably would like, given their kind of whole
thing
shtick that they're about.
Yep.
And that is fiscal responsibility and, you know, cutting public service and all that kind of stuff. So they have spent a bit, but it's terms like lolly scramble has been front and centre. I have said, you know, it's I would call it a bit of a meh budget, you know. That's how I'd describe it, because there's not really a lot in it for many average Kiwis, you know, outside of areas like, and we'll get to in a minute, you know, things like defence, some big infrastructure projects,
and but roads of national significance.
Roads,
one of them.
One big road.
From
apparently
the Waikato Expressway,
yeah,
or something?
Yeah, it's in Waikato. So, you know, there's other bits and pieces around, but there's no, I wouldn't say there's any real big winners at all.
By the numbers.
Yeah, by the numbers, it's sort of, you know, defence, big. Of course, we spend a massive amount on welfare, social development, primarily pension. Is the big one. So that's you know, a huge one. And obviously, there's someone in that coalition who is not going to have that touched anytime soon.
No. You
know? So they could be seen as a big winner because they got to continue under that same sort of system. So,
and you could argue that ACT lost in this year's budget because the government is taxing banks a little bit. They've enacted a levy on the big four Australian banks.
Yeah.
But something that, I guess, if you watch the Q&A special all about this year's budget, you'll see Jack Tame probes Nicola Willis's brain about, is that, you know, what if all the governments, what if all the banks just increase their service fees to consumers? What if they just pass the cost on to consumers? Does the government have any regulatory lever to pull to reduce them from doing that? And she couldn't give a clear answer.
And they absolutely do, but there's quite a clear roadblock within the coalition that says you're not allowed to do that, and that's David Seymour.
Yes, of course.
And he's made it quite clear, and actually Nicola Willis, to her credit, made that clear. Apparently in the budget lockup, which happens before the budget, they take all the journalists in and they sort of explain everything.
Put a gun to their head.
Yeah.
Over their head.
So they take them in and they start to explain everything. And one of the things she specifically was asked and said was that she wanted to go further on the banks, but was prevented in cabinet. And
not
that
surprised.
Is sort of subtext, David Seymour wouldn't vote for it.
Yeah.
And they need the numbers.
They sure do.
So, yes, you could tell that Nicola Willis was actually pretty frustrated when it came to the banks, because that's an area where people sort of go, well, why shouldn't we extract more from these Australian banks?
And it's I feel like it's a nationalist thing as well, because obviously they're all Australian banks. And we don't want to be seen as the eighth state of Australia? I don't know how many states Australia has. But as I mentioned before, there's these big terms being thrown around like cash bazooka, lolly scramble. Do you think it's condescending to call these policies those labels, because oftentimes what they're labelling as a lolly scramble could reduce cost of living pressure on ordinary New Zealanders who are making everyday sacrifices, like do I drive to the grocery store, do I drive to get the kids from school, do I drive myself to get chemotherapy?
Well, if you look at the things they have spent money on, they're not necessarily things that do relieve cost pressures on your average Kiwi. So where they have done these, you know, splash the cash, targeted, direct investment sort of approaches, they're not in things that are going to release, you know, any sort of pressure on families. They're not things that are going to release pressure on students. They are not sort of things that are going to have a really widespread impact on the day-to-day lives of most Kiwis.
Mm.
You know, there hasn't been a big tax reset. There hasn't been any sort of rejigging of, you know, student allowances or anything that might actually support. There hasn't been a rejigging or improvements in, say, working for families that might put more money back into families' pockets. There hasn't even been any work on reducing excise tax on fuel. You know, so there's some big stuff there that could have been done and just wasn't.
Mm.
So, yes, there's been this sort of targeted big spends in a certain few areas, but it's not stuff that's going to actually improve the lives of people on a day-to-day basis.
No, and as you mentioned before in our chat before we went on air, the government isn't adjusting anything for inflation. So they're spending on core services as much as they normally would have. The money isn't going up, which is effectively a cut. If you're not spending, if your spending doesn't adjust with inflation and it stays the same rate, that's a cut.
Absolutely. And they have been, well, some of the numbers, if you look at them, are pretty shaky. You know, they're talking about increases in wages that are going to be, you know, on record levels, over 3%. Those are projections. We'll see if they actually happen.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we'll see if wages do go up 3.1% that was in the budget that Treasury have projected. But at the same time, you've got inflation that, depending on how long things in the Middle East continue, you could see inflation push up to 4-5% if it goes for a prolonged period.
Mm.
So that's a cut.
Was the 4-5% mark, is that higher than COVID inflation? Or was it basically around the same?
It did get higher post, but, you know, it was pretty quick up and down.
Yeah.
So it was a very spike sort of inflation, and then it tapered back down. This, depending on how long things like the Straits of Hormuz continue on for, could see it stretch out. And that's where you're going to start to see the Reserve Bank, and they've already started to signal they're quite keen to raise interest rates again and try and put some downward pressure on that sort of thing. So, but it makes the government's numbers really, really shaky.
Well, speaking of their numbers, they're using an accounting technique called Obergall X, correct? Which is sort of Nicola Willis's poster child. She was very happy to get it in out over the door. And with Obergall X, that's how they're calculating or forecasting that there's going to be a surplus. Was it next year or the year after?
28, 29. So
But there seems to be a bit of doubt about whether that's like a very good accounting measure. I mean, if you change the numbers and the targets and the methodologies, then you might be able to get an outcome you want, seems to be the criticism of that system.
Well, absolutely. You know, with any sort of research, which projection is, if you tailor it to suit your preferred outcomes, you're going to get a better result. So if you tailor your
methodology... Well, this is the most kissable guy on campus. That's crazy.
You know, it's that sort of thing of you know, it's just a bizarre sort of thing. And straight away you had the chief economist at the ANZ come out the next morning and say...
Yes. Shannon Zola.
I'm not so sure.
Mm.
I'm not so sure. And same with the jobs prospects, adding 220,000 jobs to the economy over the next 4 years, I think it was, or maybe it might have been a shorter term than that. And she sort of said, you know, we've heard that those projections in the past, I'm not so sure.
Mm.
And it was the same with Bernard Hickey. He came out and said a very similar thing of, yes, they've made those projections of job increases in the past, Treasury, and it hasn't manifested. So some of those numbers, the systems they're using, it's some pretty shaky ground.
Mm, very shaky ground indeed. I want to focus in on, you know, as we were saying before, the cost of living that a lot of New Zealanders are suffering through and the poverty rates in New Zealand that have only increased over this government's tenure. Nicola Willis openly said on Q&A this Sunday that, yes, she could double benefits overnight and effectively reduce poverty in half, but she also said work sets you free, basically. It makes you dignified, and I don't disagree with that. I think working is great. But she's consciously admitted to worsening the state of life for many New Zealanders for her ideology's sake. At a time when the job market is horrifically competitive, how can she justify that decision to, you know, cut benefits to be harder on those doing it really, really tough when they can't even find a job to make themselves dignified?
Yeah, I mean, you hit the nail on the head when you talked about ideology.
Mm.
This budget has a lot of ideology driving parts of it. Although in some other bits, there would be some of that ideology would be running up against some really hard sort of decisions, because in the short term, at least, they're going to do some increasing of debt before it starts to taper off. But to answer your question around sort of cost of living and her saying the quiet part out loud,
I was surprised really when
is,
I heard it.
Yeah, it really is just that admission that this is an ideological position. This is a purely ideological position. We could take on more debt. We could stop. We could not spend on the Defence Force. We could not spend on these roads. We could do all these other things and redivert that if we wanted into the welfare system. Mm. If we wanted to, but we don't. And that's been the core message all along. And you've seen it recently with changes to the social housing system, you know, with increasing social house rents. You know, it's a weird thing to do, to say to people that are already the most struggling in our society, well, you might just have to give us a wee bit more back.
Yeah.
You know, it's that kind of, it's such a bizarre sort of line to take.
Yeah.
When most people are going to look at that and go, that's strange. Why are you taking from people who already can't afford it?
Mm.
More money, you know. It's a really odd kind of connection to make. So it's purely ideological in that space, and this is not a new thing. It's been over the last few years, especially, there has been a real push to minimise what they do directly for people. So it's trying to make it a more indirect thing, trying to create spaces that they can head into, trying to, you know, this whole idea of creating more jobs, as mythical as they might be. You know, it's all, we're not going to just sort of grab you by the scruff of the neck and lift you back up.
Mm.
We're going to kind of give you a wee kick in the back and sort of hope that you fall on your feet.
Yeah, it's insane. As you mentioned earlier throughout this corridor, a huge winner for this budget was the military. They've got a whopping new $1.6 billion to play with. Something you noted in your newsroom editorial was a quote by the Prime Minister who said, although our geography gives us time, it doesn't give us immunity. Obviously, he's referencing the high stakes and high tension global international environment. If any half-decent military wanted to take Aotearoa New Zealand, they could, of course, short of us developing a Spartan-esque martial culture, how are we going to defend ourselves? This $1.6 billion isn't going to prevent us from being invaded by Indonesia, Australia, China, if any of them wanted to take us.
Yeah, look, a big part of this is the interoperability. You'll hear that word a lot from, especially at the moment, Defence Minister Chris Pink. You'll hear him talking a lot about interoperability, which is why, I don't know how much listeners have been sort of wired into all of this. They're looking at basically replacing our current frigates. So we've got the Anzac-class frigates.
Yeah, with Japanese boats, right?
So the option at the moment is either these UK-built ones or the Japanese ones.
Right.
The Australians have just bought Japanese ones. So we'll probably end up buying the Japanese ones because of that word interoperability. So the investment is more of a, and you would have seen this actually if anyone was paying attention over the weekend, there was the Shangri-La dialogues.
Yes, Pete Hegseth said that we need to spend
3.5%. Yeah, and he was saying spend more.
Yeah.
So there's pressure from allies to do that. And it's not just the US. You know, the Australians are sort of saying as well, you know, if we're going to be doing these things, you kind of need to be playing ball. So there is a bit of pressure from others to get in on all of this. At the same time, our naval fleet is aging. Yeah, it is an aging fleet.
Mm-hmm.
And we have one of the biggest exclusive economic zones in the world. So even if it's not for war fighting, kind of, if you want to put it in those terms, military, we still have a real need to have something in that space to do the job.
Yeah.
What that looks like, where that comes, money comes from, how that's actually resourced is the big question. You know, do we need frigates or do we need something else? You know, it's that kind of, and you're going to get 100 different opinions in that spectrum of what should we buy.
Yeah.
But this also assumes that by doing that, we can't do something else. And that itself is an ideological choice that says, well, because we're spending $1.6 billion on the Defence Force, we don't have $1.6 billion to spend on welfare.
Yeah.
But that in itself is an ideological choice to say that we couldn't do both. So there's economic choices there that are put on the table that, I would argue there does need to be some investment in Defence Force, but there also needs to be investment in people.
Yeah, and I'm not sure if you saw the Linda Topp speech at the New Zealand Music Awards, but she said there's nothing in it in the budget for the culture sector here. Mm. Artists are doing it really hard, and they're going to keep struggling.
Yeah, and we talked a bit before this as well. I've got a vested interest, given my day job in other parts of the university, but the university sector was effectively cut out of the budget.
Mm.
Students are going to be actually put under more pressure as a result of this budget.
Mm.
So there are certain things that are just sitting there, in effect, research and innovation was borderline ignored. There were some bits, but it was more about the reshaping of the sector. There's some things going on, changing from CRIs to different research entities, all those sorts of bits and pieces. But in effect, research and innovation and the broader tertiary education sector, well, the university part of the tertiary sector, has seen cuts. In real terms.
Mm, mm.
Some of that money went to vocational training, but it's not even necessarily at the polytech level. It's into trades academies at the school level. So there's actually been a sort of a withdrawal of cash from any part of the tertiary research space. Yeah.
And then they can go around and say, oh, the universities aren't doing as well. We can afford to cut them.
Yeah, absolutely.
Time. Yeah, so, it's a cycle.
Yeah.
Yep. Well, we've mentioned who the winners are of this budget. I think in most respects, ACT and NZ First got something out of this budget. ACT are just happy that the government's cutting more. New Zealand First are happy that old people haven't been really affected. In fact, they're getting a little bit more with bonuses to the Super Gold scheme. Does Labour have the gall to portray how this budget is so managerial and how it reflects such a lack of vision for the future of New Zealand? Do they have the strategy to actually do that and make a convincing message to the public?
I think Labour are in a really hard spot at the moment because their whole line this year has been we're not releasing policy until after the budget.
Yep.
So they are now kind of under a time pressure themselves because they've said after the budget we'll start to release things. Well, when does that happen? Is that just going to follow a similar sort of line? It's sort of instead of following this sort of centre-right fiscal responsibility line, are they going to, diverge from that? Are they going to actually show a different pathway? What does that look? We don't really know at this point. They've mentioned capital gains, but it's very narrow and it pays for GP visits. We don't actually know more than that, really. There's no sort of numbers. There's no bold, big vision. And that goes for both sides. National have been guilty of not having that kind of big, bold vision for where the, no one I have seen yet has said, this is where I see the country in 10 years' time.
Mm.
This is where I see our people. This is where I see our institutions, our economy, where it's going, what it's going to do. National have been so tied up in that fiscal responsibility, balance the books kind of model. And Labour have been so tied into, well, we just have to kind of be careful and not do anything too crazy because, we don't really know how bad things might be. So you've got this problem on both sides of the major parties that just sitting there kind of perpetuating a lot of the status quo that, like you said, that managerial style of governing.
Yep.
It's very management 101 kind of let's just keep it steady and not do too much crazy stuff because otherwise people might get,
upset the economy.
Get cold feet, Yeah. So it's a problem on both sides, and I think the pressure really is on Labour now to, in the next month, in the next couple of weeks even, budget was last Thursday. If by the end of next week they don't at least have something to show for it, because they should have already had some stuff in the pipeline.
They should.
That all they needed to do was check numbers.
Yeah.
That's all out there now.
Yeah.
We know what it looks like. We know what the numbers that Treasury say are the numbers. So if by the end of next week they don't have something to show for it, people are going to be starting to go, what are you doing?
Yeah.
What's your plan?
I can't remember who said it, but someone said, you know, with the lights off, National and Labour look the same in the dark.
Yeah,
I can't remember who said that, but it's a great quote.
It's and it's always the line that you see come out, you know, they're just wings on the same bird.
Pretty much.
It's that kind of, you know, the left and the right wing of the same bird. So
yeah, totally.
You know, it's a little bit depressing thinking of it like that. But at the same time, I think people do need to start, you know, looking at what else exists. You know, for a long time, Labour and National have just tried to sort of perpetuate a very stable middle ground. But has it been stable? I'm not so sure it's been that stable as they would like us to think it has been.
No, they've tried to make it stable for the middle class. That's failing. It's never been particularly stable for the working class. And that just seems to continue that pattern. But thank you so much for coming on and talking to me about the budget 2026. Do you have any final thoughts, words or opinions to leave our listeners with?
I think it's just as we go into the election, you know, we're under 6 months now till the election. It's just starting to go, you know, who really aligns with what I believe in? You can see it from what National has done in the budget. You can see if you agree with that, you love it, great, there's your team. But start having a really deep look at those other parties that are out there, the likes of Greens, Top, hey, New Zealand First and ACT, if that's your thing, then really look at what they stand for, what they are bringing to the table, and how closely that aligns with you. And don't second guess your own sort of beliefs. Yeah, if you find someone that you love and you align with, go for it. Mm. That's who you should be voting for.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yep. Amen to that. Thank you so much. That was Dr. Michael Swanson from the University of Otago's Politics Department talking all about Budget 2026. He's been immersed in the budget for so long, I'm sure he's very, very sick of talking about it, but very, very thankful for his time there. It's now 9.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.